Well, thank you, Tony, and thank you, Wolfgang, and thank you, Claire. Claire designed this program and gave us our assignment, which is I'm supposed to introduce Margaret, she's going to introduce me, and then we're supposed to have a conversation about the early days of the CCR and also about Michael Ratner. We're going to talk for about a half hour. I should tell you that this conversation is totally unrehearsed, so it's going to be new to us as well as to you. Margaret Ratner Kunstler dropped out of graduate school in art history to attend Columbia Law School in the 1960s. She's a criminal defense lawyer in New York City. She currently represents Sarah Harrison and WikiLeaks. Margaret met Michael Ratner at Columbia and participated in the great student uprising there in 1968 against the racist expansion of the university, which was encroaching on Black Harlem, and also against the complicity of the university in the imperialist war in Vietnam. She worked with Michael on cases and projects from then on. She worked at the Center for Constitutional Rights for 10 years in the 70s and the 80s. And it was there that she met and worked with one of the center's founders, Bill Kunstler. She headed up the CCR's work as an education director. And then in 1983, she and Michael started the Movement Support Network, which supported individuals and organizations opposing U.S. imperialism in Central America and interference in Cuba. And later she worked on the El Salvador and Nicaraguan cases. I could say more, but I don't want to embarrass her. Let me just turn it over to her to embarrass me, and then we're going to start our discussion.
Michael Smith is a New York City attorney and author. He was on the board of the CCR for 9 years when Michael was its president. He was a dear friend of Michael's and collaborated with him on 5 books, including the recently republished How the CIA Killed Che Guevara. He founded and co-hosted with Michael the nationally broadcast current radio show Law and Disorder.
And you can get that show at lawanddisorder.org. Tony, I was going to write that down for you, and I promise I still will. What I thought we could do is start off. I first wanted to give thumbnail sketches of the 4 founders of the CCR, and then ask Margaret to talk about the CCR's initial philosophy and politics. The CCR was founded in 1966 by 4 men, 3 Jews and a Christian. Ben Smith was the Christian. He had an office in New Orleans, which was convenient. He was the only lawyer in the whole state of Louisiana that would take a civil rights case. And New Orleans was the seat of the Fifth Circuit, which had 3 federal judges who, amazingly, were sympathetic to the civil rights movement. So the 3 New York Jews had a contact down south. Ben Smith had grown up poor in northern Louisiana, so poor that he actually went hunting and fishing to feed the family. When he was a young boy, he toured around the northern part of the state with his father. His father's job was collecting debts from poor black people. Well, that's a redundancy, but nonetheless, Ben was very moved by the conditions he saw while going around with his father. He put himself through college. He was a brilliant man, really a polymath. He was a good mathematician, a good navigator, in New Orleans. And he put himself through college and then went to Tulane Law School, which was the elite law school in the South. And he opened up a practice in New Orleans. Ben went up to Detroit in 1962 and urged the National Lawyers Guild, which was soon to move its headquarters from New York to Detroit, urged them to send lawyers down south. He said, we really need help down here. And that became a project that the founders of the CCR were involved in and the National Lawyers Guild was involved in, lawyers who went south to support the civil rights movement. Morton Stavinsky, whose name was later changed to Stavis, grew up as an Orthodox Jew on the Lower East Side. He went to the City University of New York in the 30s. It's a very radical place. There were Stalinists and Trotskyists and Social Democrats, anarchists, conversations, actions, all sorts of activity at CCNY. He got radicalized there and shed his Orthodoxy. He was also very brilliant. He got into Columbia Law School. In those days, you know, racism in the United States wasn't just directed at black people. It was also directed at Jews in the form of anti-Semitism. And Jews couldn't get into the white shoe law firms. That's what we call the fancy elite law firms. They couldn't get into the main corporations like IBM. That's why Michael and Bruce's father started his own business, and my father started his own business. So Stavis, who couldn't get a job in a white shoe law firm, got a job working for the government in D.C. And when he got down there, Robert Wagner, who was a senator from New York, had just written the Wagner Act, which set up the National Labor Act, which for the first time allowed unions to form legally. And Stavis came to the attention of Wagner. At age 23, Wagner hired him to be one of his top staff people. And then he jumped ship from the Wagner staff to the United Electrical Workers Union. The UE was a radical union. It was led by members of the Communist Party or people sympathetic to the Communist Party. And he moved to Newark. And in Newark, he was hauled in front of the House Un-American Activities Committee for having left-wing sympathies. His son reports that at that time, his babysitter weighed 350 pounds. He needed a bodyguard. Stavis was the one that incorporated the CCR in Newark in 1966, originally as the Law Center for Constitutional Rights. A few years later, the law part was dropped and it became the CCR. Why did they incorporate it? Well, Bill Kunstler and Arthur Kanoy and Morton Stavis and Ben Smith had been working in the South. They were talking to each other almost every day. And they thought, well, we should just institutionalize this relationship. And secondly, they thought if they set up a not-for-profit, then people could give them money and get a tax write-off. So Morty incorporated the CCR in Newark in 66, and right away they got $40,000 from a radical lawyer in New York called Bob Bohm. And they were off to the races. Within a year, they got more support. Cora Weiss, Peter Weiss's wife, had the Nehru Foundation. She gave them money. A rich Episcopal lady in New Orleans gave them money. And within a year, they had three people on their staff. Arthur Kanoy, another brilliant person, got into Harvard, which was rare because in those days there were quotas in the elite schools for Jews. And he was the coxswain on the Harvard crew team. This is a very, very slight, small man. And but he would boss these, you know, the Elliots and these ruling class people who were on the crew. And then he would finish being the coxswain and hustle up to Harvard Square to pass out leaflets. Bill Kunstler said that in those days he was a little Lenin. And when he got out of Harvard, he went into the Army during World War II. When he got out of there, he went to Columbia Law School, where he was a classmate, although he knew, but he wasn't friendly with Bill Kunstler. But he went to Columbia, and then he was offered, unusually, he was offered a job with a white shoe firm. He lasted 3 months, and he too joined the staff of the United Electrical Workers Union. And the last member of the quartet was Bill Kunstler. Bill had formed a practice with his brother Michael Kunstler and with Arthur Kanoy. And they used to tell judges we're the new KKK. Bill was a mischievous young kid. He called himself in his autobiography, he says, I was a real pisser. He said, I was Peck's bad boy. He was a troublemaker from the beginning. Grew up in Harlem. In those days, Harlem was not just a black neighborhood, it was also a Jewish neighborhood. And Bill went to Yale. He majored in French poetry. He graduated with honors. He, too, went into the Second World War, where he received several medals. When he came out, he went to law school. And he set up a practice in the suburbs. Bill was a liberal at that time. And he affiliated himself with the American Civil Liberties Union. And they asked him to go out to California. The Carol Chessman case was going on then. I don't know if you're familiar with it. It was a very important case in the 50s concerning the death penalty. Chessman had killed a couple of people on Mulholland Drive in Los Angeles. And he was remorseful and regretted it. And he begged for mercy. And there was a big movement to try to get the death penalty relieved. And Bill went out there to work on that. And on the way back, the head of the ACLU said, will you stop off in Jackson, Mississippi? There are some freedom riders down there, and we want you to go on there and observe what's going on. Do you know what a freedom rider is? These were people, blacks and whites, who boarded interstate buses to desegregate public transportation. And so Bill went to Jackson, Mississippi. When these people got off the buses, they were savagely beaten. That was the routine. And that got him involved in the civil rights movement. I'm going to finish with this point. Bill represented Martin Luther King for 6 years. He represented H. Rapp Brown, the head of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, SNCC. Brown is famous for saying violence is as American as cherry pie. And he represented Malcolm X's daughter. He was a brilliant courtroom lawyer and a wonderful speaker with this beautiful bass, sonorous voice. Really a wonderful man. I could go on about him because I met him when I was in law school in 1966, but I'll stop here and just say that we'll get into the various cases that they started off with in 66 were important examples of movement lawyering, and we'll talk about in the course of our discussion. Margaret, I'm going to ask you a question. What was the philosophy and politics of the CCR back when they formed in 1966?
Well, at that point, they had, interestingly enough, faith in the law. And that was probably because the Fifth Circuit, which had four judges that were pretty interesting, and the Fifth Circuit covered Alabama, Georgia, Florida, Mississippi, and Louisiana. Now, those were the states in which the freedom rides were occurring and the marches were occurring. And so every time there was a problem in a city, they would go to the courts. They would take the cases out of the racist state courts into the federal courts. Now, that was a trick that they figured out, because representing each individual person who was arrested, either on a freedom ride or on a march, would take years, and it would take more people than they had to represent people. So what they did was they removed the cases into federal court and either got an injunction against continuing or a mandamus, the law was held unconstitutional, or whatever they did, but they were very successful in pulling the state courts cases out of the state courts and into to the federal courts. Unfortunately, somebody caught on to that. And eventually, those cases were narrowed down, of course. And at first, it was only cases where the crimes were serious crimes. It became individualized, and that wonderful remedy disappeared. That remedy disappeared at the same time that the Center for Constitutional Rights was forming, interestingly enough. So all of their thoughts about only doing affirmative litigation, only doing impact litigation, only representing social justice movements kind of had to switch a bit, because now we were into the 1970s. We had the Vietnam War. We had people individually accused of terrible crimes and had to be represented separately. What did continue as impact litigation was the women's rights movement, because there, the center developed through Nancy Stearns an ability to take state cases and make them federal cases, and at least even in the state cases, bring the cases, instead of bringing the cases on behalf of doctors, brought the cases on behalf of poor women who couldn't get abortions. So that that was in support of a movement, and that continued. I want to read you something that came out in the early 70s at about the center, which defined the philosophy. It starts off with the illusion of lawfulness, which I won't read. And it then recites government atrocities. And it says, it is in this context that the CCR has, since its founding in 66, played a central role in advancing the goals of progressive organizations and individuals while protecting them as they engage in their struggles. Because it has been the law that has been used as a tool of repression, it can be the law that is used as an instrument of resistance. Because it has been the law that has so often given legitimacy to governmental abuse, it can be the law that is used to strip away the facade of legitimacy where it exists and deprive it where it is sought. And because it has frequently been the law that has stood as an obstacle to change, it can be the law that is implied, that is employed as an agent of social progress. Aside from using the law, and really the distinction between the center and the ACLU is, the center really doesn't have much respect for the law. The center looks at the law as an instrument of repression and deals with it on that pragmatic level. The other part of this that has developed and continued is the fact that the center has always been involved in social movements and continues to be involved in social movements. The staff originally was selected because they were embedded. They participated, the women's rights movement, the Puerto Rican independence movement, all of the people who were hired because, not only because they were great lawyers, but because they were devoted to various separate movements. And that kept the center on its path. And it kept it devoted to the movements that it supported. Both Michael and Bill, over and over again, recited how the law was, if I could have some water, that would be great. After walking up so many stairs, they really felt that without a social justice movement supporting what was happening, nothing could happen, because they really believed that things happened in the streets, not in the courtroom. And anything that happened in the court that was successful happened because of what was happening in the street. So it was the same thing with the women's rights movement, with every movement that we have experienced. The only time that the law has been a successful tool is when there were people on the streets asking and moving for change. The law on its own is very ineffective and boring, to say the least.
Margaret, Bill didn't start out that way. He really did have a belief in the law, and I wanted to ask you about what he thought and how it changed and what caused him to change it.
Bill described the Chicago 8 trial. Now, that was a trial in Chicago. 8 people were accused of crossing state lines to cause a riot, and that was around the 68 National Convention. And 8 people were indicted and accused of inciting the riots that went on. In fact, it was quite clear that it was a police riot. And it was reported as such. It wasn't a people's riot. It was a police riot that caused the whole thing. Anyway, Bill's experience during the trial made him realize that the law was not always helpful. And in fact, he could see that it was a tool of repression. And it was his Rubicon. He described it as that. And from then on, he understood the law not as an instrument of change, but as a way of preventing change. And that really radicalized him and changed his whole point of view.
Yeah. What did he say? It's an instrument of the ruling elite to perpetuate itself by any means necessary for as long as possible. That was what his understanding of the law was. He also quit the ACLU twice. The second time, remember, was when the ACLU defended the right of Nazis to demonstrate in Cleveland. And Bill said, "I represent the movement, not the Constitution." Margaret, let's come up to the work that Michael did at the center around Central America. And I wondered whether you might talk about that. And then I was going to talk about Michael's work with respect to the defense of the Cuban Revolution. But first, let's talk about Central America, because Michael got very active for about 10 years. Went down there, 30 times to Nicaragua, and was very active in promoting and hoping that those revolutions in El Salvador and Nicaragua wouldn't be crushed by the United States.
After Reagan was elected in 1980, he had his first cabinet meeting where he handed each cabinet member a copy of the Mandate for Leadership, which was a report created by the Heritage Foundation, which mapped out exactly what they wanted to accomplish during the Reagan years. Michael, at our first staff meeting after the election, also passed out this book, not to everybody because we didn't have the money to purchase that many, but you know, five copies went into the library, and it was Michael's advice to everybody that you'd better start reading this because this is what's going to happen. And what the Heritage Report said was, we've had too many FBI agents staying inside the FBI. Now, that was because previous to that, there was a law passed supposedly to catch mafiosa. It was an anti-mafia law. And it changed the definition of immunity. And immunity no longer was use immunity. It was the immunity only for what you said at the time. You couldn't be indicted for exactly what you said, but you could be indicted if other evidence was brought up or it was a different crime. So it changed it. So the FBI then became homebound. They only subpoenaed people to grand juries because this was a wonderful tool. You could indict people. You could put them away for lengths of time, for 18 months, even more than that, if they refused to testify. So that's what the FBI did. Well, the Heritage Foundation came out with this report saying, we've had these agents inside for too long. We have to push them out on the street. We're going to put them out on the street, and we're going to have them walk around and intimidate people. This is going to be much more effective. And we're going to start getting rid of these radicals in Central America. That's the other thing we're going to do. I mean, they had a whole list of what they were going to accomplish. They were going to invest more money in arms. And all of these things did, in fact, happen. It was a remarkable coup on their part. Michael, having read this report and having a discussion in the group, understood that what we had to do was to immediately begin to protect the movement against these things that were going to happen, because it was we didn't know that it was going to happen, but we were thinking, okay, what are we going to do if this happens? And Michael was, you know, the way Michael was so powerful and so brilliant was he knew what was happening. He was conscious of it, and he prepared everybody for it. He knew what was happening before it happened, and he set up ways of dealing with it. So he figured out strategies for litigation, and he had the idea for the Movement Support Network. The Movement Support Network was to function to protect the movement in all of these cases. So for the first thing that the Movement Support Network did was to support people who were traveling to Cuba. We put out pamphlets saying what to do when you're coming through customs, what to say and what not to say, so that people were prepared and they knew what to do. Then we had a hotline that took reports of everything that was happening all across the country. Now, this was a work of genius, because what that did was it allowed us to have a central place where we could list how many break-ins there were by the FBI, how many visits there were by the FBI, how many grand juries were started by the FBI. And this not only encouraged people to call in and feel better about what was happening because we had people talking to them, but it gave us a way of approaching the press. The press loves statistics. If you could say to the press, we've had 15 break-ins, we've had 100 visits by the FBI, then they begin to listen. So we had a way of protecting the movement, which was genius, because Michael understood that the movement was not enough protected during the Vietnam War period, and here was a way of protecting the movement at this point. At the same time that he was protecting the movement, it was an understanding that the lawsuits would serve the movement. In other words, it wasn't the fact that the lawsuits were going to accomplish an end to intervention in Salvador or an end to intervention in Nicaragua. We knew that wasn't going to happen. But the lawsuits were factual explanations of what was happening. It summarized U.S. intervention, U.S. techniques, U.S. activities, and then the groups that had formed around these anti-interventionist activities had an easy way of understanding the vocabulary. In other words, they knew what was happening, and they were brilliant about it, but we supplied them with an additional vocabulary to come out and organize. So the lawsuits were embedded in the communities. They weren't separate entities. The facts were put out there for the movements to use. So between the Movement Support Network and the lawsuits, it was an absolutely brilliant strategy. Unfortunately, the U.S. government turned out to be stronger than we were, and stronger than the countries that they intervened in. So the revolutions were ultimately, except for Cuba, not successful. We were over-optimistic.
we're coming to the end of our allotted time with respect to the conversation that we were asked to conduct, and we do want to have a conversation with amongst all of us. But I did want to talk about the Central Park jogger case, Yusuf Salaam, the fact that Bill Kunstler took that case to the center refused to take it, what we learned from that, and how Michael got the center involved in the challenge to executive authority, all the litigation that's been going on since 9/11. So, Margaret, would you tell that story? You know, the Central Park joggers were falsely accused. They were children, and they were falsely accused of raping and beating a white woman jogger in Central Park. And the press was scandalously ferocious against them. Our friend Donald Trump famously offered a $100,000 reward and wanted to give them the death penalty. That was the atmosphere in New York with respect to the Central Park joggers and Yusuf Salaam. And that's Bill was not representing Yusuf at the trial, but he came in on it at the sentencing part. And at that point, Margaret's going to take over and tell the story about what happened and then how the center later on got involved in the stuff after 9/11.
Actually, Bill became involved in the jogger case on the appeal level, and the resentencing level. When Bill took the case to the center, it was refused. It was refused because the concept was that the center was, you know, very famous with their women's rights litigation, and how could they possibly justify representing rapists, accused rapists and convicted rapists, and It just would interfere with their funding. It just would not be healthy for the organization. And they refused to take the case. In 2011, when the First Military Act was promulgated, Michael looked at it and he said, the center has got to get active here. These people are defined as the worst people on earth. We're going to have roundups. We don't even know what's going to happen. And the center has to be prepared to deal with it. The center has to acknowledge that they're going to represent all of these people who are rounded up, all of these people who are thrown into Guantanamo. We didn't know at that point exactly where they would be thrown, but they were eventually taken to Guantanamo. So Michael went to the board meeting, to this staff meeting, and he said, you know, I'm going to recommend this, and I know it's a very hard thing now because New York City has had a terrible experience. We've all been very close to it. We've all probably lost friends there or, you know, been some way affected by this terrible thing that's happened to the World Trade Center. But, you know, we have to step back from this. We have to learn from our past. We have to learn from what we did. And he went into the meeting and he read from Bill's autobiography about how the center had refused the Jogger cases and explained to them, you know, sometimes you have to overcome what your first reaction is and understand the political importance of what you might accomplish here. And the center then agreed, despite overwhelming thoughts that they were going to lose their funding, that they were going to get hate mail. And all of these things did happen for a while. There's no question that that was a result. But Michael explained to people that that's what they had to do. And Michael went on to explain, my daughters did a film about their father a few years after he died. And in that film, Michael explained in their interview of him that he had come to understand why Bill had represented all of these people who people said, how can Bill be representing the first World Trade Center bombings? How can he be representing all of these people, these Arabs accused of crimes? I mean, how is it possible? And Michael said to them, he understood at that point in time that it was so important to stand up and be bold enough to represent the people who were called the worst of the worst, because if you didn't do that, then you had no ability to function in society after that, because it would all be over at that point.